for the impossible dream and see things not as they are, but as they ought to be. Tickets available at pptopa.com or 954-437-4884. That is pptopa.com or 954-437-4884.
The University of Miami invites ambitious business professionals seeking to become better negotiators, thinkers, and leaders to learn more about its professional MBA program. The UM School of Business will host an information session on Tuesday, April 8th at 6 p.m. The next class, starting in July, meets Saturday mornings and Monday evenings. With numerous electives offered and an international study trip option, you can tailor your MBA experience. More information about UM's upcoming April 8th information session at miamimba.com.
Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, the Smithsonian American Art Museum's traveling exhibition, Art America, the Latino Presence in American Art, opens next week at FIU's Frost Art Museum. Judith Bishop has the details. Film critic Dan Hunak previews the 19th annual Palm Beach International Film Fest. Chef Norman Van Aken serves up a word on food. And our Broward Arts calendar features Jody Horn Leshinsky. The Florida Grand Opera's presentation of Puccini's Tosca opens tomorrow night at the Arsht. Here's Charles Greenfield with more information.
Opera fans are in for a fantastic penultimate showcasing March 29th to April 12th of Puccini's Tosca at the Florida Grand Opera. Performances are held at the Arsht Center's Ziff Ballet Opera House and the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. After a full season starting last fall with Mourning Becomes Electra and ending with Thais in early May, the FGO brings to stage the famous tale of the opera singer Florian Tosca, her lover Cavaradossi, and the great villain Baron Scarpia, chief of Roman police. As the three-act opera unfolds, Puccini's genius for dramatic arias perfectly encapsulates the fluctuating emotions of love, jealousy, and revenge. The Milan premiere of Tosca took place in La Scala on March 17, 1900, under the baton of Arturo Toscanini. Principal singers in the upcoming FGO production are Cara Shea Thompson as Tosca, Rafael de Villa as Cavaradossi, and Todd Thomas as Baron Scarpia. To access some of the richness of Puccini's Tosca in the Florida Grand Opera production, I recently spoke to Justin Moss, director of Broward Operations and South Florida's leading opera raconteur and FGO spokesperson. Justin Moss, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you for having me back, Charles.
What does Puccini represent in Italian opera from an historical and musical perspective? Describe briefly the range and depth of his works.
Puccini really serves as a bridge completing the transition of Italian opera from the period of very formal structure where you had well-defined recitative, well-defined arias, to something really completely and totally written through and a progress into modernity, if you will, from ancient operatic traditions. Puccini brings opera all the way into the modern age. These written through operas, such as Richard Strauss's Salome, for example, where it's hard to single out what we used to call an aria, really. Puccini really does this complete, thorough job of bringing Italian opera into written through works. Still, he remains very, very lyrical, and you can pick out and hear those arias. Those beautiful melodies are still very much present and very obvious.
Let's talk a little bit about the origins of Tosca. There's Sardou's play, the actress Sarah Bernhardt, the two librettists Giuseppe Giacosa and Luigi Illica, and a very brief account of the plot. Basically, Floria Tosca, the painter Cavaradossi, and the great villain, Baron Scarpia. What a great name.
Great name. Isn't that just the arch villain, right. Scarpia? How could you ask for anything more sinister sounding than that? Sarah Bernhardt entered into a long partnership with Victorien Sardou, the French playwright. He wrote a great many plays during his career, 70 of them, many for Sarah Bernhardt, none of them produced today. But Tosca was his greatest triumph, really. He wrote it for Sarah Bernhardt. It was a huge success. It's difficult to over-describe how successful this was. She performed Tosca more than 3,000 times in France alone, but toured the entire world in it. It was a long play of five acts, very, very wordy, as was the style at the time. All of that has gone completely out of fashion today. But Puccini saw the play twice with Sarah Bernhardt and was determined to make an opera from it. He thought, this is perfect, and he was right. His theatrical instincts never failed him. He negotiated permission to create an opera, and he took this thing to the stage in Rome, where the action takes place, for its premiere in 1900, January 14 of 1900. Critics were a little lukewarm about the piece because it did, after all, depict torture, murder, and suicide. Not exactly the kind of a show you want to drag your family to, but it sounds like Puccini was writing it for today's audience, doesn't it?
In a way.
But it was shocking, unsettling, but immensely powerful dramatically, and it never failed to make an impression.
Let's briefly talk about the leitmotif, which is Wagnerian. He did seem to borrow something there.
He did. Wagner had come up with the idea of creating musical depictions of people, events, ideas, values, and whatnot. And all of this, you know, made a big impression on people all around the world who were writing music. Everyone had an ear to the ground, keeping track of what Wagner was doing and what he had created. So Puccini, in fact, opens his opera Tosca with a magnificent, disconcerting chord, which is the theme for Baron Scarpia. And it also, that music represents the evil that dominates throughout the course of the opera. He also has themes that represent various other attributes that recur during the course of the opera. And you can hear something and go, oh, yes. And be reminded of exactly what he's referring to.
Well, you did mention the fact that the critics weren't excited at the beginning. I believe Joseph Kerman, an American critic, called it a shabby little shocker. And even French composer Gabriel Fauré called it disconcerting vulgarities. Yet it's terribly popular even today.
It, I believe, has been about the number two most frequently produced opera in America after Puccini's other wonderful achievement, La Bohème. Those two works are produced more frequently than any other operas in the United States today. It's remained immensely popular with audiences. And I think one of the reasons it provides just extraordinary opportunities for a great soprano, a great villainous baritone, and a magnificent tenor to really shine. They can create both a dramatic and musical impression that audiences will never forget. And that's why the leading prima donnas have always fought for opportunities to sing Tosca. They covet this role.
Well, let's go act by act, the three acts. In Act One, Scarpia's menacing motif at the very beginning and Cavaradossi's Recondita Armonia with its sustained high B flat and Tosca's Non la sospiri, the overall sounds of the church, the bells, the Te Deum. What is his strategy, Puccini, to seize the listener?
Well, he's setting us up with this beautiful, intoxicating love affair between Mario Cavaradossi, who is both a political activist and a painter. He's completing a painting in the Church of Santa Maria della Valle in Roma. His lover Tosca sweeps into the church gloriously, but before long she begins to grow a little bit jealous of him. Later on, the Baron Scarpia comes in looking for an escaped prisoner whom Cavaradossi has hidden in the church, and he suspects Cavaradossi of being involved in this duplicity. He sets a trap, fans the flames of Tosca's jealousy, and then finally determines that she will lead him to the prisoner whom he seeks.
Now, in Act Two, things get very menacing indeed. In fact, there's actually torture. And you have Iame de Convenal of Scarpia, and that's followed by Tosca's Vice d'Arte, perhaps the most famous aria in the opera.
Yeah, this is one of the most compelling scenes in all of opera. Tosca sensing something really sinister is up when she says, "You've got to free my lover." And Scarpia replies to her, "Io? I? No, you." And she realizes something terrible is afoot, and she says famously, "Quanto? How much?" And he says, "Quanto? Il prezzo, the price." He's saying, "I don't sell myself to beautiful women." And then when she realizes the magnitude of the trouble that she's in, the music and the action stop, for which Puccini's been criticized sometimes, but it absolutely freezes, and Floria Tosca steps forward with her magnificent aria, "Visi d'arte, visi d'amore." "I've lived for art. I have lived for love. I've never harmed a living creature. I brought flowers to the Madonna's altar. I gave secretly unto her. And why, O God, for all of these good deeds, have you rewarded me thus?"
And then in Act Three, the plot becomes thicker and trickier even. The famous aria, "E lucevan le stelle," cover Adosse, summing up pretty much the third act.
Yeah, this is a great, great opening to that tragic final act of this opera. Tosca, of course, has promised herself to Baron Scarpia if he will free her lover. She's reneged on her promise at the last minute and murdered him, though, and snuck out to bring her lover away from the prison where a mock execution is to take place, lest the people of Rome believe that Scarpia has gone soft, as it were, and is freeing prisoners. Cavaradossi realizes that this is probably the last moment of his life, and he sings a remembrance of the erotic passion he had for Tosca, describing how the stars were burning, and he could hear her footsteps on the gravel path. He could hear the gate creaking as she opened it, coming for their rendezvous in the gardens in the middle of the night. And never, he sings, have I loved life more.
Now, with such a description, very briefly, could you tell us about the three principal singers for the Dade and Broward concerts and a little bit about set design, costumes, and, of course, the orchestra under music director Ramon Tibar?
Well, we have a magnificent set that's coming to us from the other side of the country at the Seattle Opera, and it's very realistic, beautifully painted, very, very exciting. We have two sopranos who will be singing the title role of Tosca, Carachet Thompson and Jovanka Jean-Baptiste, both of them seasoned Tosca's Carachet, having made really a specialty of the role, seeing it all over the world. Todd Thomas, the baritone who will portray Scarpia in all of our performances, has been acclaimed as one of the very finest Scarpias singing the role today and is in very, very great demand among companies all over. Two tenors will be sharing the role of Mario Cavaradossi, Rafael Davila, and Diego Torre will be alternating in performances in that role, both of them magnificent voices with just that gleam of sheer tenorial beauty that is absolutely essential for this role to be successful. We think it's a very, very strong group of artists, and that every person attending any of these performances is going to come out feeling they've really gotten their money's worth and had a thrilling evening in the Opera House.
Well, I can't wait to see it myself, and I want to thank you, Justin, for being on South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you for having me, and I'll see you at the opera.
The Florida Grand Opera is certainly worth a go with its engaging artistic and dramatic interpretations. Despite the reduction from 5 to 4 productions in recent years, the FGO seems determined to manage their way in a conservative and sensible fashion to survive in tougher times. Years of solid and successful productions are its trademark, and it's not hard to imagine that the FGO will continue its quest to remain one of the country's leading opera companies. For information on tickets and scheduling, contact 1-800-741-1010 or go to their website at fgo.org. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Charles Greenfield.
Charles Greenfield is a classical music contributor for the Sun Sentinel and has written for the Miami Herald. You can email him at cdgpm@bellsouth.net. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat continues in just a moment. Svani per sempre il sogno mio d'amore, dove fuggito.
You can drink, dine, and discover at the 19th Annual Bank of America Wine, Spirits, and Culinary Celebration on Friday, April 4th at the Museum of Discovery and Science located in downtown Fort Lauderdale. The evening features a progressive sequence of wines, spirits, and craft beers with cuisine from nearly 50 of South Florida's most renowned restaurants. VIPs start at 6 p.m. with a martini reception and end with the ultra-chic VIP Party Lounge. Tickets at 954-713-0954 or online at modsevents.org.
Once a month, our South Florida Arts Beat program features a live musical performance featuring South Florida artists. And every week, we bring you important news on the arts in our region. We're WLRN. That's just one way we're serving South Florida.
Bass Museum of Art presents their monthly Idea at the Bass Family Day this Sunday from 2 to 4. Audubon, Florida will teach about the importance of birds such as the bald eagle as the treasure of the Everglades, accompanied by fun art activities. Details at bassmuseum.org.
Hello, Ed Bell with you here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Later on the show, film critic Dan Hudak previews the Palm Beach International Film Festival. Chef Norman Van Aken presents A Word on Food, and our Broward Arts Calendar features Jody Horn-Leschinski. Now, contributor Judith Bishop takes a look at the exciting new exhibition coming to the Frost Art Museum at FIU.
When the Smithsonian mounts a traveling show, smaller museums all over the country are honored with a spot on the A-list. Here in South Florida, the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum on the campus of Florida International University will soon host a highly praised Smithsonian exhibition. It's called Our America, the Latino Presence in American Art. That's a perfect fit for Miami, a city that values and nurtures the Latino experience. Around 85 works of art created here in the United States by contemporary Latino artists will be on display at the Frost from April 2nd to June 22nd. Visitors will see a variety of styles, from abstract expressionism to conceptual art and performance art as well. In addition, there will be more traditional genres, including landscape, portraiture, and sculpture. Over 62 featured artists will represent echoes of their Mexican, Puerto Rican, Cuban, and Dominican descent. Their art weaves ancestral cultures with their assimilation into the American mosaic. Many of the pieces belong to the Smithsonian's permanent collection and were acquired by curator E. Carmen Ramos. When she was hired by the Smithsonian, her goal was to expand the Latino facet of their world-famous collection, and she has done just that. E. Carmen Ramos is our guest today with a curator's perspective on the new exhibition at the Frost Museum. E. Carmen Ramos, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. It sounds to me like you have a dream job. You're an art scholar, you're working in the Smithsonian, you're of Latin descent, and your principal duty at this world-famous institution is to acquire Latino art and then mount exhibitions. It sounds pretty perfect.
Absolutely. I've been enjoying my job since I've been here. I've been at the Smithsonian for a little over 3 years, and my major project has been Our America, the Latino Presence in American Art, that's soon going to open at the Frost Art Museum, and I'm delighted that it's going to that venue.
We are too. Now, when you first interviewed at the Smithsonian, what did you say to win them over, and how are the goals that you set for yourself being accomplished at this point?
I conveyed the fact that I believe that Latino artists are American artists. I work for the Smithsonian American Art Museum, which is a museum that's devoted to the art of the United States. And I firmly believe, and my scholarship has revealed, that Latino artists are very much part of a community of American artists working here in this country. And I think I conveyed to them the importance of really positioning Latino art from that perspective. If you look at many exhibitions of Latino art in recent years, it's often associated with Latin American art. And my work here at the museum is really to sort of look at the other half of that equation, to look at the relationship between Latino art and the national context in which it's born, which is the United States.
It sounds to me like you have a balancing act, and a difficult one, because you have to represent in your selections a wide variety of countries and a wide variety of artistic media. So what criteria do you use in making those determinations?
Well, for this particular exhibition, which is different than acquiring works for our general collection, which is much broader. I really focused on the period since the mid-20th century, when an idea of a Latino or Mexican-American or Puerto Rican or Cuban-American art really starts to emerge. So in many ways, history led me to make certain selections. I was very interested in identifying works by artists that really had a connection to the movements of American art, as well as artists who recalibrated key themes in American art and culture. So selecting works for this exhibition were very much focused on trying to tell a particular story about the development of this field that we now call Latino art.
There are about 85 works of art in the show. Are there any underlying themes that uniquely reflect the Latin experience here in the United States?
I think yes and no. I think there are many artists who, for example, came of age during and after the Civil Rights Movement and have explored issues of politics and Latino identity. And there are others who are working before that period, you know, figures like Carmen Herrera, who came to the United States in 1935 from Havana, Cuba, and really was part of a large international scene of artists that were interested in geometric abstraction. So I think that there's a range of work that reveals many Latino artists who are interested in exploring aspects of their cultural heritage, issues of politics and living in the United States, as well as those that have other concerns, many of them tied to their particular genre of interest or their medium, or to key sort of subjects and themes within the history of American art, like the landscape, for example.
Lots of things to figure into the equation there. One question that strikes me is that, like all the other waves of immigration, Latino immigrants often live the American dream and become inspiring success stories. But like other groups, others are subjected to poverty and prejudice. Is there what you might call a dark side of the assimilation story that's reflected in this exhibition?
I think there's a complex story of migration that is told in the exhibition. There's a whole section, in fact, in the exhibition called Migrating Through History. And it looks at how Latino artists have explored this idea, this basic idea of our culture, which is that we are a nation of immigrants. Well, for many Latinos, they were not immigrants. Puerto Ricans, for example, became American citizens in 1917 after having been occupied by the United States since the Spanish-American War in 1898. Mexican Americans living in the Southwest became Americans overnight after the Mexican-American War. So the path to becoming American is not always even through a history of immigration. So there are many works in the exhibition that explore that complexity and the ways in which that history has not really figured in the history of American art and culture.
Talk us through some of the highlights of the exhibition, some of your favorite pieces, and some of the major artists who are represented.
There's a wonderful work in the exhibition called Cowboy and Indian Film by Rafael Montañez Ortiz, who is also known as the founder of El Museo del Barrio. And he was a practicing abstract expressionist working in New York City in the 1950s when he became interested in film and using film as the medium for his own art. Like many artists working in that period who were also interested in film, he didn't have enough money to make his own film. So he purchased existing films and found a way to alter them and then project them as his own work. At the time, he was also exploring his own Yaqui ancestry, and he began to incorporate ritual into his art making. So he took a tomahawk, which was or is a an implement that we associate with Native American culture, and he took a film, Winchester 73, which is a very well-known cowboy and Indian film from the 1950s, and he took the tomahawk and chopped it up, put it in a medicine bag, shook it up, re-pieced it together again, and then screened it as his own film. And it's an amazingly hypnotic work where the narrative and the soundtrack of this film are completely altered. And it's meant in many ways as a critique of the ideas of Western expansion, the idea that cowboys are good and Indians are bad. It was a real critique to the myth of the cowboy in American history. That's definitely one of my favorite pieces.
That sounds terrific and worth seeing that at the exhibition for sure. There's a question also in the art world at large that women painters and sculptors are often underrepresented. Is this also true in Latin art, and are maybe the growing number of women curators making a real difference?
I think that the fact that this exhibition focuses on the period from the mid-20th century and on is a very significant in sort of exploring issues of gender and how they play out in this exhibition. There are many works by women artists in our America. Many of the works that dominate sort of the square footage of the exhibition, in fact, are by many women artists, some of the largest works in the show. And I think that the field of Latino art emerges really and coincides with feminism, you know, and with the increasing presence of women artists in the art world. So in our exhibition, there are actually many works by women artists, artists like Carmen Herrera, who I've already mentioned, younger artists like Teresita Fernandez, who is originally from Miami, Florida, other artists like Maria Magdalena Campos Pons, another Cuban-American artist who's based in Boston. So there's a really strong presence of women artists in our America.
Well, we look forward to seeing Our America at the Frost, and we thank you for joining us today on South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you so much for having me.
The exhibition opens at the Patricia and Philip Frost Museum on April 2nd, and it closes June 22nd. The museum is located on the campus of Florida International University here in Miami. For more information, log on to thefrost.fiu.edu or telephone 305-348-2890. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC and CNBC. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will return in just a moment.
March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. As one of the most prevalent cancers in the U.S., colon cancer is also preventable through screenings. Cleveland Clinic Florida offers diagnosis and treatment of complex cases. Cleveland Clinic's team of colorectal surgeons have developed treatment options which are now considered standard around the world. This has provided patients with innovative care for colon cancer. Details at 800-639-DOCTOR or clevelandclinicflorida.org.
South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Arsht Center, Gable Stage, Slow Burn Theater, Pembroke Pines Topa, and Ballet Palm Beach. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. Culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts.
It's South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up on the show, Chef Norman Van Aken serves up a word on food, and Jody Horn-Leschinski gives us her Broward Arts Calendar. Now, film critic Dan Hudak previews the 19th annual Palm Beach International Film Festival.
In 2003, director Rich McKay's documentary Broadway, The Golden Age, by the legends who were there, won the Audience Award at the Palm Beach International Film Festival, and understandably so, given the candor and verve of the stories it tells. This year, McKay returns for the 19th edition of the festival, running April 3rd through the 10th, with a sneak peek of Broadway Beyond the Golden Age, which is scheduled for release in the fall of this year. In addition to giving McKay its Visionary Award, the festival will honor Emmy and Tony Award-winning actor Robert Morse, who also appears in the film and is now best known as Burt Cooper on Mad Men. They're giving Morse its Lifetime Achievement Award. In this excerpt from the film's trailer, you'll hear the voices of Glenn Close, Jeff Daniels, John Lithgow, and Liza Minnelli.
Remember that line of chorus line? Don't tell me Broadway's dying because I just got here. I think I'm the one that said that.
It was a very exciting time to begin in New York.
I thought we were wonderful and that fortune had thrown us together.
We all started together.
We were all gonna make it. It was all gonna happen.
I remember Meryl sneaking off to second act, Liza, and coming back and saying, wow, that woman gives everything, everything.
And you hear a voice say, ladies and gentlemen, Gwen Britton is unable to perform. The role of Roxy Hart will be played by Liza Minnelli. And you're on.
You know, I found some footage from Chicago.
Ah!
Have you ever seen it?
No! Oh, darling, please can I see them?
Of course.
Those were the best dance numbers on Broadway. That was the year that both Fosse and Fred and John and myself won the Oscar, the Emmy, and the Tony.
An audience Q&A with McKay will follow the screening. The opening night film is Belle, which is based on the true story of Dido Elizabeth Belle, the illegitimate mixed-race daughter of a Royal Navy admiral in late 1700s in Great Britain. Although her aristocratic status yields some social privileges, the color of her skin prevents her from fully participating in all traditions. The closing night film is former 90210 star-turned-director Jason Priestley's Cass and Dylan, starring Richard Dreyfuss, about a dying doctor and the 22-year-old girl who makes him reconsider checking out on his own terms. Throw in 14 world premieres, 8 U.S. premieres, and a plethora of parties, seminars, and other special events, and you have the makings of a very exciting week for film lovers in Palm Beach County. We recently caught up with the woman who's making it all happen, Festival President Randy Emmerman, to learn more. Randy, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. I wanted to know, how many years have you been at it with this festival now?
This is actually my 20th year that I've been a part of the festival.
Wow, congratulations. What have you learned after all these years?
That I'm crazy. I've learned how small the world really is and how we really can communicate with each other.
Interesting. Is that because of the films that come in from all around the world and how they all have similar themes, or is it because of the people you seem to consistently bump into being in the film festival industry?
I think it's from the films, from the filmmakers that we see returning over and over again, people I see and bump into around the world, just like you said, and the message that they bring to us.
I think one question, people may not be aware of this. What does a film festival director do the other 50 weeks of the year when your festival's not going on, or in your case, 51 weeks?
Well, it really takes about 10 months to put together from, you know, starting the film submissions, because we all get in, some festivals get in thousands and thousands of films that you have to go through. And it you start off with a draft of what you'd like your next year to be like. Looking at other trends of what's going on around the world, what you think your market might be interested. You know, you want to do something different all the time to keep everybody excited.
So it's constantly evolving, and it always struck me as endless work. I just wasn't sure what exactly the endless work was. So that's
right. I mean, you start off, you know, you have to go raise money for the following years. You have to get it known that you start accepting films for the next year. You have to start planning on locations and theaters, and you know, there's so many moving pieces. And really, we have 168 events in 8 days.
Have you had it happen in the past, not this year, but you've had it happen that you've had a big-name celebrity commit to the festival and then not show up or then decommit at the last minute, and then all your promotional material is saying, hey, so-and-so is coming. You can throw them under the bus now. This is all water under the bridge years in the past.
We have, and, you know, one thing is, though, the celebrities that we bring in, it's not like a lot of charities that we're paying them. They're doing this on their own time as a favor to the festival. So if work comes up, they have to go to work. And, you know, there's nothing really we can do about it. You know, they need to work. Their films get greenlit all of a sudden. They might have committed to us months before a film wasn't greenlit or they weren't put in a role. And then they are. So, you know, just like you and I have to go to work, they have to go to work.
Speaking of stars, one thing you're doing this year is you have not only the Broadway content with Rich McKay coming to town, which is kind of being fondly sentimental of yesteryear on Broadway, but you also have the tribute to classic Hollywood on Saturday the 5th, which I think is a really cool idea because it's all about kind of old school Hollywood and bringing the old back in with the new. And it's a clever programming approach.
Correct. And it came out of the Broadway idea with the Broadway film. You're exactly right. And, you know, because Broadway and, like, we made up the party at Sardi's afterwards. And then the classic, you know, the golden era of Hollywood and the glamour of it.
You mentioned the party at Sardi's afterward. That's Bogart's in the movie Copalis.
Right.
It's going to be transformed into a Sardi's. So are we going to have caricatures on the wall and two-foot-high pastrami sandwiches and whatnot at that party?
Well, I couldn't say we're going to have pastrami sandwiches, but, you know, maybe some surprises with the characters.
Oh, very cool. A lot of different things going on, a lot of variety at the festival this year. Mm-hmm. The new programming of Jewish and Israeli-centric films, I think, is a really smart idea. Tell us about that.
Well, there, you know, Palm Beach County, South Florida in general, has a very large Jewish population. And it's not just for the Jewish population, their films, but it's for, you know, everybody to be able to see these films and partake. There were a lot of films available this year. The Israeli films that were getting so good, and there is a market for it here. A lot of these films don't make it into the movie theaters or on cable television or network television, and they're very, very well done.
Right. Those are very well done. The documentaries from all over the world, they're very well done. We got the shorts program as usual. We got the focus on local filmmakers that you have every year. All right. So with all that important stuff out of the way, let's talk about The Great Chicken Wing Hunt. A film that I is totally after my own heart. This guy travels 2,627 miles and eats 284 variety of wings, and he must have the greatest girlfriend in the world because she goes with him throughout the entire process.
And it's the 50th anniversary of the chicken wing, which I didn't know before this movie.
Yes, which is fabulous.
And afterwards, you're even going to be able to sample the winning chicken wing.
Can I be a judge in the chicken wing contest for that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Other than we're only making the winning chicken wing, so you'll have to judge on that one.
Sounds good. Also, seminars.
You know what? It's something else about it. Film festival. Who knew it was the 50th anniversary of the chicken wing?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We needed a film to teach us that.
The film itself, it is a documentary. Can you tell us more about the film itself?
I don't want to give it away, but, you know, it's a search for the greatest chicken wing around.
Concerts this year as well. The Dubliner and Meisner Park is going to be busy. Tell us more about your music coming up.
Well, it ties into a film. We have a world premiere of a film called Mary Lost a Soul, and this group actually does the title track in it. So they're going to come. It's called Above Seclusion. They're well-known in the L.A. market, so they're coming to perform for us here in South Florida.
Very cool. We have Don Hemingway with Jude Law. We have a movie called Ida, which Tony Scott and A.O. Scott in the New York Times called it the best movie that he's looking forward to seeing again in 2014. Another cool movie here called The Girl on the Train, which seemed like a nice mind-twisting, you know, really keep-you-guessing type thriller. American Jerusalem, Jews in the Making of San Francisco really stood out to me because I never thought about a connection between San Francisco being built by Jews.
Right. And the other thing is we have filmmakers coming from every corner of the world. They're traveling here on their own dime. And look at some of their films. We have someone coming from the UK with a film called The War We Knew, and he actually won our festival 2 years ago with a totally different kind of film called The Best Little Whorehouse in Rockdale. And he's coming back with his next world premiere. We have filmmakers coming from China, from Hong Kong, New Zealand, Australia, the Netherlands, Norway, Argentina, Israel, Canada, Croatia, Kosovo, Turkey.
Fantastic.
I mean, and they're all traveling over here, and it's a way for people to meet these people and get to know them.
Sounds fantastic. Randy, best of luck with the festival this year.
Thank you so much.
The 19th annual Palm Beach International Film Festival runs April 3rd through the 10th and will be held at the Movieco Parisian 20 and IMAX at City Place in West Palm Beach, Cobb Downtown at the Gardens, Lake Worth Playhouse Stone's Eck Theater in Lake Worth, and the Cinemark Palace 20 in Boca Raton. Special events will be held at select locations. For tickets and more information, go to pbifilmfest.org or call 561-362-0003. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Dan Hudak.
Chairman Emeritus of the Florida Film Critics Circle, Dan Hudak is a nationally syndicated film critic. You can visit him online at hudakonhollywood.com. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue right after these messages.
It's South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN. Great to have you along this afternoon.
South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center presents two nights of Music Masters. New flamenco guitarist Jesse Cook brings his blue guitar tour to Miami on Friday, April 4th, and salsa legend Poncho Sanchez and his Latin jazz band perform Olé Coltrane with special guest James Carter on Saturday, April 5th. More information at smdcac.org or 786-573-5300.
Hazardous waste like oil-based paints, pool chemicals, and pesticides don't belong in the trash can. Help protect the environment by safely disposing of household chemicals at a home chemical collection center. Information at miamidade.gov/publicworks or dial 311 to learn more.
Gable Stage at the Biltmore in Coral Gables presents The Mountaintop, the award-winning Broadway hit by Katori Hall, running now through April 13th. On the night before his assassination in Memphis, Martin Luther King retires to room 306 in the Lorraine Motel. While a storm rages outside, he is confronted by a maid with some surprising news, and he is forced to confront his past and the future of his people. The Independent calls it wondrous, hilarious, and heartbreaking. Tickets at Gable Stage at 305-445-1119 or gablestage.org.
Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Ed Bell with you. And now, Chef Norman Van Aken gives us a word on food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the offs and fade, with shafafa on the side. Shoo-doo-dee-doo-ya-doo-doo.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food is strawberries. They're out there, bursting through the black dirt fields with a red-lipped lusciousness that only a woman as brazen as Mother Nature could muster or afford. Folks, I'm talking about strawberries if you haven't guessed already. To get your own, skip the grocery stores at this time of year. You won't have to drive far. The Florida strawberry season is upon us and in full swing. We often go to the town of Homestead and Knossberry Farms for ours, but truly, many places in Florida will work this time of year. You will be rewarded with a day where you can, if lucky, revisit your childhood and pick your own brimming basket of sun-ripened strawberries. I remember my earliest experiences picking our own. Our mother would drive us to a U-Pick farm not very far from our Illinois home. We joined other families in a kind of controlled foraging of the fields, cared for by generations of family farmers there. I cannot escape the memory of the mosquitoes that came after us those muggy mornings near the Wisconsin border. Do you remember when you were a child and you watched as a mosquito sunk its sticker in you and drew your blood? I remember thinking, how outrageous, and smacking that little sucker so dead that reincarnation would be unlikely for it. Today, I might find myself confessing to the dead insect, drying on my arm. I try to be Buddhist-like when I can, but you crossed a line when you came near my collected strawberries. As a child, I suffered less of those moments of introspective evaluations. In the mid-1800s in the United States, there were only about 1,400 acres of cultivated strawberries. That ain't much. Barely a drop in the bucket. The reason for this is they were growing so abundantly in the wild that no one bothered. Strawberries were originally native to the New World, probably Peru. Yet, it was after a trip abroad and being handled by some of the greenest thumbs of Europe that the strawberries we know today truly came into the orb of greatness. Florida and California are the two biggest producing states of strawberries. I am actually on the Florida Strawberry Growers Association's Chef's Advisory Board. We hauled some of our state's berries up to Iowa last year so I could demonstrate a few recipes to national magazine writers how to enjoy them in various ways. My ancho strawberry barbecue sauce was a favorite. My point was to prove that strawberries are wonderful in desserts, but they, like tomatoes, a fruit, have savory abilities. There is nothing that can compare with strawberries that are perfectly ripe and still holding the sun's sweetness. I prefer having strawberries that have not been refrigerated. Only slightly cooled is best. One of my favorite combinations is strawberries with a little balsamic vinegar and sour cream. You could slice the berries if you like for more exposure to the other two ingredients. Another way I'm getting my love of the red beauties is in a goat's milk and strawberry beverage made by the folks at Coach Farm in New York. If you are going to buy a berry that has traveled a long road, this is one of the best ways to go about it. Above all, I love my wife, Janet's, strawberry lemonade jam. That is a secret recipe. Let Iowans find their own. I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Norman Van Aken is the author of My Key West and is also the director of restaurants for the Miami Culinary Institute and Tuyo in downtown Miami. Please tune in tomorrow morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Potatoes. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat entertainment calendar. And today we welcome back Ms. Jody Horn-Leshinsky, Assistant Director of the Broward Cultural Division. How are things in Broward County?
Oh, things are buzzing here, Ed. We've got so many events planned, and beginning with Friday, May 9th from 9 a.m. to 12 noon at the Museum of Art Fort Lauderdale, your listeners are invited to a free Creative and Cultural Industries Symposium where the discussion will be centered on the future of the Latin American, Caribbean, and South Florida economies. A panel of distinguished speakers will talk about a new study called The Orange Economy and an Infinite Opportunity. In a bid to encourage debate in Latin America and the Caribbean on the contribution of creativity as a key element of economic and social development, members from American University's Center for Latin American and Latino Studies and Broward County local business leaders will discuss the importance of how this report's new data impacts this international region's economy. On Tuesday, April 1st at 2 p.m., your listeners are invited to meet German painter and installation artist Henning Haupt when he presents a gallery walk and talk on his current exhibition, Drawing Lines, Making Space, at the Coral Springs Museum of Art. Now through April 27th, Gallery 6 and Doing Business As presents Emergent, a new dynamic exhibition featuring all media art and artists from the Artists as an Entrepreneur Institute. The Latin Fever exhibition is currently on display at the Glass Gallery in Pembroke Pines through May 19th and features artists from Colombia, Cuba, Brazil, and Venezuela. On Saturday at 3 p.m., the Coral Springs Museum of Art presents the Chautauqua Series featuring Nzinga Osanawan, award-winning visual artist and published poet presenting a program on Haitian folklore through African influence modern dance. The Dania Beach Community Redevelopment Agency presents the second annual Arts and Seafood Celebration this Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Frost Park. Since the Odd Duck Bazaar only takes place on the last weekend of March at the Fred Lippmann Multipurpose Center in Hollywood, attendees should arrive early in anticipation of having first pick at the goods. Parking is free and guests can expect an abundance of unusual shopping, live music, do-it-yourself crafts, free giveaways, and refreshments. Musicians, writers, and performers, join the Jets on the Peck Terrace of the Museum of Art Fort Lauderdale on Saturday at 6 p.m. for a night of new entertainment with an open mic night. Later on, hop on the free NSU Shark Shuttle to the Fat Village Art Walk between 8 and 10 p.m. This weekend, the South Florida Ukulele Fest 2014 is bringing some of the best ukulele performers in North America for a full weekend of concerts, ukulele skills workshops, ukulele shopping, and family fun beginning at 10 a.m. in Esplanade Park on 2nd Street in downtown Fort Lauderdale across from the Museum of Discovery and Science. The South Florida Symphony presents the concert, A Summons to Life. Music director Sabrina Maria Alfonso will conduct the orchestra in a program that includes Mozart, Ellen Zwillich, and Schumann on Sunday at 7:30 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. Now through April 20th, the Broward Stage Door Theater presents The God of Isaac, a comedy concerning the identity crisis of a young Jewish man attempting to find out what it means to be a Jew. The Carbonell Awards annually pays tribute to the very best theatrical productions on regional stages and features South Florida's top entertainers and theater insiders. The 38th Annual Carbonell Awards Ceremony will be held on Monday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. If you would like more detailed cultural event information, please visit artscalendar.com, Broward County's complete guide to the arts. Never miss a thing. Get there.
Special thanks to Jody Horn-Lashinsky, Assistant Director of the Broward Cultural Division, for all of that great event information. Great weekend to you, Jody.
Thank you, and to you too, Ed.
We'd like you to know that the Aaron Libos Reality Jazz Rock Quartet will feature their new CD, Turning Point, Thursday, April 3rd at The Stage, Miami, and will also be presenting the video for the first single from their set called Screens. More info is available at aaronlibos.com and catch their performance here on South Florida Arts Beat Friday, June 20th. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. Tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our online producer. Thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Charles Greenfield, Judith Bishop, Dan Hudak, Norman Van Aken, and Jody Horn-Lashinsky. Call us with your comments, 305-995-2258, or fax us your event information to 305-995-2221. You can also email it to us at info@wlrn.org. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.
You've heard of the Windy City.